This is Regionally Speaking here on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. It's Thursday, which means it's Reporters Roundtable Thursday, where we get reporters from some of the Northwest Indiana area media to talk about the stories they worked on this week. And two prominent stories in the news, and we'll talk with the reporters about that as well. We'll have with us Ed Bearshank from the Times of Northwest Indiana. His colleague, Mark Chase, will join us as well. And we'll talk with Michael Hawthorne, who's a reporter for the Chicago Tribune, about his story, which deals with the Indiana Harbor Coke Company, a polluter of Northwest Indiana, and why the EPA isn't cracking down on that company. On this Reporter Roundtable Thursday, we take a look first at some news in Gary and in Hammond. And for that, in those stories, we turn to Ed Bearshank with the Times of Northwest Indiana. Ed, thanks for being back with us here on the show today.
Oh, thanks, Chris. Good to be back.
We have a couple new businesses, one in Gary, one in Hammond. Let's talk first here about this one that's proposed to come into the city of Gary. A company out of Illinois is going to relocate, I guess, everything or pretty much everything and move into the Steel City. Tell us about that.
Yeah, they're proposing to relocate, looks like their entire business model over to Gary. 100 jobs. They're talking about a $35 million relocation. So, a lot of money, a new 250,000 square foot facility and offices, and I think the 100 jobs is what we're seeing right now, or could be some other jobs associated with that.
What, from what you understand, seemed to interest Alliance Steel Company in wanting to relocate out of Bedford Park, which we know is a suburb, south suburb of Chicago that's very intensively industrial. What's brought them to come into Indiana?
Well, you know, from I think part of it is just the location. This is a great location by the water, a lot of rail. The city is really investing, I think, a lot in infrastructure there. And I think that's going to be a big advantage to them, too. You know, Gary, one of their big advantages is they are have a center there with the rail and not too far from the airport is really close by there. So I think all of that was attractive.
I know the city's worked very hard to bring new businesses in, Mayor Karen Freeman Wilson in particular, and Joe Van Dyke, who's the planning and redevelopment director, has worked on this project in particular. Do we know if the city council is bringing any incentives to the table on this? Or things like this already been worked out, or they still have more to work out on this proposal?
I think that still will be worked out, yeah. But I'm almost certain we're going to be seeing some type of incentives. I just don't think they're ready to release that information.
Probably
yet.
Not yet. I also understand, too, that not only is Alliance Steel coming in, but I guess there is a companion company, a separate company. It's not with this particular firm, but it's another company that does maybe does trucking work for the steel maker. That's part of the deal, too, isn't it?
Exactly. And I think that's part of the, you know, some additional jobs be coming in with that company. And we'll we're seeing quite a few different trucking companies come in, so that's kind of interesting.
Do you have any idea when this company is, from what information you have and what you've learned from the project so far, they want to get this thing started and have this place open?
You know, I think they're looking to start pretty soon. Their timeline right now looks to be construction to be completed by the fourth quarter of 2018.
Wow.
So that's a fairly aggressive timeline. They have to go through all their permitting processes, and we're talking about relocating a pretty good-sized company. So kind of interesting, Steel coming back to the city there, maybe re-energizing that with some of the other steel investments going on there as well.
That's great. One of the other stories I know you covered this week for the Times from the city of Gary dealt with the city council and about a tax increase. Tell us about that and when it's likely to take effect.
Yeah, that should take effect next year. I think we wrote about this a little bit earlier. Not only Gary, but Merrillville and some other communities are looking to increase what's called this cumulative capital tax. They can use it for quite a few different things. We're looking at, I think an increase of about $22.40 on a $100,000 home.
Mm-hmm.
For residents. Gary, I think, has seen a lot of loss in income, and they're trying to look for any ways they can to try to recover a little bit of that money back.
I'm sure that probably city council didn't approve it unanimously. I'm sure that there were some dissenters on the panel.
Yeah, we it was 7-1 vote. Councilman Lavita Sparks Wade opposed it, and I think one of the things she wanted to get a little bit more information in regard to this, and you know, there was, of course, I think at least some residential opposition. As far as another tax going on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I understand that one of the usual critics of the city of Gary's administration had a chance to speak out, I guess, at that meeting and said that the city should be doing a better job with the tax money they're getting currently.
Right. That's Mr. Nowacki, who ran for mayor himself a while back, and he frequently criticizes the city, and I think that was his contention anyway. Mm-hmm.
We're talking with Ed Bierschenk, who's a reporter, covers Gary and Hammond for the Times of Northwest Indiana. And I know that, Ed, one of the stories that you covered, sticking with the business end here, is a story that deals with the Hammond Redevelopment Commission, that they've approved an agreement with Lear Corporation, which already, of course, has a plant that makes automobile and vehicle seating. It's within the city of Hammond, but I guess that the company has some big expansion plans. Tell us about that and how that's coming along.
Yeah, the city is going to be giving them a $4 million incentive package to basically relocate their facility. They were a little constrained where they were at, and they're looking to increase the number of workers by about 200, going from 550 to 750. And one of the good things about this location is it also allows for future expansion. So I think their contention is, hey, hopefully as we grow, we can grow with the city at this location. And for Hammond, it was a good deal, too, because they were able to find some land that was kind of landlocked right now. Hammond doesn't have a lot of large contiguous pieces of land that they can make available.
And yeah,
in fact, we're lucky to find this.
Yeah, I encourage, for example, right now the Lear Corporation plants on 165th, and there are bigger businesses on either side of it. Actually, there are businesses on one side, and there's a shopping area on the other, so they don't have much room to move it within the current property there, I'm sure. So this would work out well. So obviously, both the plants will be in operation in Lear, as best you understand?
I think what they're going to do is they're going to shut down the other one, the other facility. And then that, from what I understand from Phil Tallien, though, they've already gotten some, the city's gotten some inquiries about that. So, so he's very, I think, enthused about another company perhaps coming into that location.
So whenever Lear's Corporation's new plant that's being built there on Michigan Street, there east of Indianapolis Boulevard, is open and ready for operation, they'll shift operations over to that and then just close up the old plant, and then it looks like that somebody's kind of waiting in the wings to buy that property.
Yeah. Yeah, it looks like it, which is good news. Yeah.
From what you understand from Phil Tallien and from Mayor Tom McDermott Jr., the expansion of the city of Hammond industrially, business-wise, has been going on for some time. There have been a lot of small operations that have opened up and some consolidation and the like, but this looks like it's probably one of the first really, really big changes in a while, isn't it?
It is. It's one of the largest ones that we've seen in quite a few years, probably since Phil's been on board. When we're talking about this number of workers, they've got some other projects going on. I think we might see some more going on at Oxbo. That's been a really good as far as commercial businesses going in, and I wouldn't be surprised to see some more go in there.
I know the city of Hammond is particularly proud of Oxbow Landing because that's a revitalization of a very troubled area for the number of years. It was a troubled, at least as far as the police department's concerned, a trouble causing problems there with an apartment complex. That, of course, has been long torn down, and that whole area has been developed into what it is today that you can see from Kennedy Avenue and from the Borman Expressway. It's just growing almost every month. Something looks like something new is happening there, to be sure. One other thing I know that you covered for the Times this week, Ed, was dealing with the Hammond City government issues, and in particular, one that's been in the news for a number of years. It's been the expansion of the South Shore Line, and we've heard different stories about what is planned for that area. The double tracking, of course, in the area between Gary and Michigan City, as well as the expansion of the area to the west of there in Hammond. Tell us what the city council took up and how that discussion came about.
Yeah, they went ahead and after negotiations between the mayor and the railroad and the RDA, they went ahead and decided on a package that was probably maybe 50% less than what the original package called for. They're looking at spending about $450,000 a year over. Or their contribution anyway will be about $450,000 a year for the next 30 years. Might come up to, you know, depending on how the what it actually is 15% of their portion of the tax. So as it grows over time, hopefully it might even be more than $450,000 a year. And I think that's what Mayor McDermott is saying, that you know, over this 30 years, it might actually grow to $15 to $20 million.
Awesome.
So this, like I said, this has been going on for a while. I think one of the big pushes or one of the big incentives was the Gateway Station, and the Mayor McDermott saying this is really the way I can help that community in the north side of the city. You know, there, we don't see a lot of opportunities in that particular area. And this is something that we can really offer them as far as growth.
I know that the Mayor McDermott made that a condition of whether the city would even be involved in this project at all. And getting that word back to the to NCTE and to the RDA said, you know, we'll be happy to go along with this, but only if you meet these conditions. And the Gateway Station certainly is one of them. It's definitely in that plan for that extension.
Right. Yeah. The controversy, I think, was more over the South Hammond Station.
Yeah.
If you look at the resolution, you'll notice there was no mention in the resolution of the South Hammond Station because there has been some significant opposition, but the rail line really says they need that in order maybe to get the funding and also for their bottom line, because it is one of the top, at least they say, one of the top ridership stations.
I would know, too, that there still are some residents in Hammond that are very concerned about that project at the south end of the project there and how it's going to develop, I guess, worried about homes that might have to be purchased or taken over, I guess, to make way for the tracks.
Exactly, yeah. And we have a group there that the mayor kind of agrees with them. You know, we don't want to get those homes acquired before we're certain that project's going to go in. You don't want to take some projects where I've seen this happen in the past at other projects where homes are acquired, all of a sudden the project falls through and you're left with some empty buildings there and you're disrupting people's lives. So hopefully that won't happen. Hopefully they'll wait until they have the money in hand.
That's great. Ed Bereshenk is a reporter who covers news in Hammond as well as in Gary for the Times of Northwest Indiana. Ed, once again, thanks for being with us here on Reporters Roundtable Thursday, and hope to have a chance to talk with you again very soon.
Okay, Chris. Thanks.
There's a story that has shown up in the Chicago Tribune about an East Chicago air polluter, and efforts to crack down on the company's pollution is being met by basically stonewalling, at least in the opinion of some environmentalists in the EPA under the Trump administration. And, of course, all this delay to the chagrin of Indiana and Illinois environmental groups. Michael Hawthorne with the Tribune researched and has the story online as well as in print this week, and Michael's with us to talk about it. Thanks for being with us here on Regionally Speaking.
Great to be with you.
Well, tell us first a little bit about, for people that are not familiar with this, Indiana Harbor Coke Company. What are they, and where do they seem to fit into the sordid environmental mess that we're facing?
Well, you know, in that massive industrial area on the southwest shore of Lake Michigan, there are a number of oil refineries, chemical plants, steel mills. There's a peninsula that juts out into the lake. Steel mills were built there many years ago. They were formerly owned by different companies. Both of them now are owned by ArcelorMittal. the blast furnaces of those steel mills need coke to fuel those blast furnaces in the making of iron and steel. And this has been an inherently dirty, inefficient process over the years. A lot of pollution problems around the country from coke production. Several years ago, 1989, this separate company built out on that peninsula a series of what are called coke batteries or coke ovens. They're these giant ovens where a special type of coal is shoveled into the oven. It's heated up at these, you know, incredibly high degree temperatures, and the coal is essentially distilled down into higher energy, high carbon fuel for the blast furnaces at the steel mills. Mm-hmm. That creates a lot of pollution in the process, a lot of volatile chemicals, and in the old method of making coke, those chemicals would be kind of siphoned off and turned into other industrial chemicals like naphthalene, benzene, used in other parts of industry. But oftentimes they had a lot of problem capturing everything, would go up into the atmosphere, into surrounding areas. You know, some parts, even within the last decades last couple of decades, you had coke ovens in parts of the United States where the emissions were on par with what you see in the dirtiest parts of China and India. So this company, Indiana Harbor Coke Company, they're a subsidiary of another company that's based in the Chicago suburbs called SunCoke. They came on the scene and said, hey, we've got this different process. It's a more efficient process. It's a more environmentally friendly process. And instead of creating all these different gases, we're going to burn all these excess gases in the production of coke and turn it into a fuel for a power generator that will be located right next to the coke ovens. So it sounded great. The federal, state EPA, the steel industry, everybody thought this was in the words of a lot of politicians, a win-win situation.
Right.
What turns out is that's not the case. It hasn't been the case at that facility or most of the other facilities that this company owns. There's records that the company itself provide to the state of Indiana show that since at least 2005. Routinely having problems with its emissions controls, excessive amounts of sulfur dioxide, which is a key ingredient in smog, particulate matter, most of us call it soot, lung disease, heart disease, premature death, and then also lead, which is a toxic metal that in very small amounts can damage the developing brains of children. And that's a relevant thing in East Chicago because that's what the EPA is cleaning up in neighborhoods surrounding old lead smelters, pollution that was left and deposited in the area many years ago by industry that it's long since gone. The EPA is on one hand cleaning up that residual pollution. Meanwhile, there is this ongoing stalled enforcement action for a polluter that is adding more lead to the atmosphere and potentially endangering people in the area.
I know that the EPA under the Obama administration and even before under the George W. Bush administration had been working to get the settlements with this company to get the cleanup underway as needed. But as you've mentioned in your report in the Tribune, things are basically stalled under the Trump administration, and we're only 6 months into the administration.
Well, I think this is one of those cases that from people that I talked with, both inside and in the agency, the U.S. EPA, and people who were in the agency in the Obama administration, this was essentially teed up. They have a bunch of different cases around the country in various states of completion. The EPA and the Department of Justice had gotten the parent company of Indiana Harbor Coke into what's called the consent decree. It's a court ordered agreement for different things that the company has to do to clean up pollution. There's usually a fine involved, things like this. Very common way to settle in environmental enforcement cases. they had done this with two of the of the company's other coke operations, one in southern Illinois near St. Louis, and one in Ohio, the southern Ohio. And this one was kind of left on the table. In part, if you read through the company's documents that they filed with the SEC, they were still negotiating, figuring different things out. For whatever reason, there were a bunch of violation notices sent to the company. The legal settlement hadn't been reached yet. And what I've been told is that since the Trump people came in, all of that, not just at Indiana Harbor, but also in other parts of the country, a lot of these enforcement actions have just kind of ground to a halt. Mm-hmm. And there's a bunch of reasons for that. It's not uncommon for that to happen when a new administration comes in. You know, you've got new people, you've got new political hires. They want to get up to speed on what's in front of them. And, you know, oftentimes, no matter what agency is involved, there's a lot. So there's usually a delay. But the delay now, 6 months into the administration, it seems a lot longer than under previous administrations. Even administrations that, you know, in the political world were seen as more hostile to the mission of the EPA, say the George W. Bush administration or the Ronald Reagan administration. Enforcement was much more of a priority comparatively in those administrations. So, and you've got a budget out there. You've got a president who was elected saying he wanted to essentially abolish the EPA. You've got an EPA administrator who spent his political career, who built his political career on suing the EPA as Oklahoma Attorney General, and a budget that's been proposed that would severely cut back not only on cases of what's called the Superfund program, cleaning up abandoned industrial sites like the one in East Chicago, but also affecting enforcement of existing companies that are still emitting pollution into the air and discharging it into our water.
We're talking with Chicago Tribune reporter Michael Hawthorne here on Reporters Roundtable Thursday about his story about the Indiana Harbor Coke Company, its pollution legacy that it has continued to add to the problems in East Chicago, and how the Trump administration's EPA is not exactly rushing to enforce the laws and try and deal with this polluter. And I understand in your article as well, too, which you can see online on the Chicago Tribune website, and it's also listed as well on the Post Tribune website, that there's one in particular, one environmentalist who is very, very unhappy with how this case has basically not been following through. Tell us what the fellow who's in charge of Environmental Integrity Project has to say about it.
Oh, sure. Eric Schaefer was the top enforcer, civil enforcer at the EPA up into the early days of the George W. Bush administration. He resigned in protest over a completely different matter, but you know, the way he describes it, he understands how these situations work. So this case here in Northwest Indiana, in his opinion, should be a slam dunk, in his words. But from the people that he knows that are still the career staff at EPA, that everybody has essentially been frozen since Scott Pruitt, the new EPA administrator, arrived. And that what's relevant there is one of the first visits that Pruitt made. Outside of visiting, coal mines and meeting with governors and industry officials, one of his first other official visits was to East Chicago to visit the neighborhood that's being cleaned up through the Superfund program. And at that time, after he met with local officials, he said, "Cleaning up this community was one of my top priorities as EPA administrator." Mm-hmm. The Superfund cleanup was already in the works. It was already ongoing. They had a plan going forward to dig up soil and replace the lead-contaminated soil, making sure that people in the community were safe, reviving this long-delayed cleanup. That was a fight that had happened before the Trump folks came into office. And now it's just the matter of timing, getting through different construction seasons when the weather is fine and getting that work finally done. The question here still is, you know, there are existing sources of pollution. You know, we might not have as much pollution. We might not have as much industry as we once did. But the question is, holding those folks accountable to following the law, it's a tough job. It requires a lot of expertise and personnel and support personnel. You have to have monitoring and testing, and you have to have lawyers who can be back and forth across the table with the company lawyers. Those are things that are potentially in jeopardy if the Congress passes the budget as proposed by the Trump administration.
That's aside from the folks at Region 5 in Chicago concerned about their jobs, because I know that's one of the threats that's been made early on by the new EPA administrator and the Trump administration in general, that they would start closing up regional offices, and Chicago might be one of them. That hasn't happened yet, and we can certainly hope it doesn't with all the pollution problems we have here in our section of the Midwest, to be sure. Have you gotten any other feedback or reaction here since your story came out, Michael?
Well, I think a lot of people, since the story came out, there was a petition now that has gone directly to Administrator Pruitt in reminding, you know, the top levels of the EPA, the political appointees in Washington, that, hey, this situation is out there. Here's the record. And you know, we would like you to make this a priority. So there are different ways of trying to, you know, kind of raise attention. One way is, you know, you get a newspaper story and people talk about it on the radio. Understanding what's happening there. You know, I think, as you said, you know, Northwest Indiana, you know, the area has always been a hot spot in the debate about industry and pollution. Of, you know, the early days of the EPA in the 1970s, a lot of the work that was done by the EPA was in Northwest Indiana and in the Great Lakes in general, because mm-hmm. you know, we had this long history of industry and pollution, and you know, my predecessors at the Tribune spent a lot of time, you know, traveling around Lake Michigan, you know, in particular, and right there at Indiana Harbor, the Indiana Harbor Ship Canal, just, you know, all that pollution over the years. You know, there's an old classic picture in the Tribune of one of my predecessors pulling his hand out of the water. It looks like he's got a black latex glove on.
Yeah.
And just recently, you know, there was a big controversy in East Chicago about dredging. The canal, it's so full of sediment and highly polluted sediment that it was difficult for cargo ships to get into the harbor. You know, and then they ended up digging a lot of that out and depositing it in a landfill that's right next to several schools in East Chicago. So there's a long history of that historic pollution. And then this open question about what's going to happen with the ongoing sources.
Yeah, that's the latest kerfuffle before the East Chicago City Council is what the residents think about this this open top container dumping that's been done by the contractor that's doing the canal dredging work. That's another problem we're all facing here. You can see Michael Hawthorne's article here about the Indiana Harbor Coke Company and the settlement that has been reached with the company with the EPA on hold, basically, in a way, by the Trump administration. Michael Hawthorne, thank you very much for being with us to talk about it here on Regionally Speaking on Reporters Roundtable Thursday.
Good to be with you.
Let's turn now to Bill Dolan of the Times of Northwest Indiana. He's covered a number of stories on his beat this week. Bill, thanks for being with us today.
Hello.
Will you fill us in first on the latest woes facing Munster Town Councilman John Reed?
John Reed was arrested a year ago and charged with operating a vehicle while intoxicated. Monday, after many delays, he pleaded guilty to what we call OWI, and he was given a suspended fine and a suspended sentence. He asked for and received expungement of the results of a breath test that he took.
Mm-hmm.
I want to be clear that the conviction, the OWI conviction, it was not expunged, just the results of the breath test. And this is happening during a time when the Lake County prosecutor has promised to crack down on drunken driving, and typically drunken driving OWI charges were reduced to a lesser offense called reckless driving in the past. But after some criticism of this last year, prosecutor Bernard Carter vowed that he would try to he would only agree to plea agreements in which the driver agreed to plead guilty to the charge of OWI, drunken driving. And that is, in fact, what happened with Mr. Reed. And he said that, Mr. Reed said that, he is sorry and that the prosecutor is and has kept his word on being tough. And he was obviously now he'll have to face the public when he stands for a re-election in a couple of years.
I was going to say that it may have more of an impact if he wants to run for re-election here rather than now, just having dealt with the legalities of the charges against him.
Right. We have written before about how these OWI cases got reduced and sometimes weren't even reported to the Bureau of Motor Vehicles in Lake Station. Hundreds of cases were involved in that, and that had to be corrected. It involved the state police investigation. Nobody was ever charged with wrongdoing, but the Bureau of Motor Vehicle had to catch up with all of the paperwork that eventually flowed to it after many years of the paperwork not having been sent to it to make sure that driver's records reflect any arrests and convictions.
Bill, one of the other interesting stories that you've had in the Times, online and in print as well, too, involves the new U.S. attorney for Northwest Indiana, Thomas Lee Kirch II. And I guess it's a question, I guess, because he has to kind of change jobs within the federal court structure.
Right. A couple of weeks ago, President Trump nominated Tom Kirch to be the next U.S. attorney who would handle federal prosecutions, criminal and some civil matters in the northern third of Indiana, replacing Mr. David Kapp, who had that job for many years. Mr. Kerr still has to be appointed by the U.S. Senate. No one expects that to be any issue. He's a Republican. The Republican majority in the Senate is likely to go along with it. The thing that has to happen is that Mr. Kirsch is currently a private attorney. He was formerly an assistant U.S. attorney and, in effect, a federal prosecutor trying many cases in the courtroom. And then he went into private practice. Now his he'll have to wind down his private practice. And one of his clients is the Portage mayor, Mr. James Snyder, who is set for trial early next year on public corruption charges. In a strange turn of events, Mr. Snyder's defense attorney will soon be in a position to prosecute him. But federal conflict of interest laws wouldn't allow Mr. Kirsch to handle his former client's case. What will likely happen is another U.S. attorney will take over that case and prosecute it independently of Mr. Kirsch. Mr. Kirsch wouldn't have anything to do with the strategy or the typical things that U.S. attorneys and federal prosecutors do in a criminal matter.
I suppose they probably have to work extra hard if those discussions come up in conferences within the U.S. attorney's office about that particular case with Mayor Snyder, that to make sure that Mr. Kirsch is not around.
Exactly. They could do this two ways. They could move the case out of northern Indiana to Illinois or downstate if they chose, or they could just bring in another prosecutor, an interim special prosecutor, if you will, who would only handle the Snyder case or any other cases if Mr. Kirsch has other clients we don't know about who are facing charges in U.S. District Court. The special prosecutor would then handle those cases as if he were the special prosecutor, and then Mr. Kirsch would, there would be a wall, an information wall, between that special prosecutor and Mr. Kirsch.
Bill Dolan works for the Times for Northwest Indiana and covers stories for us and talks about them here on the Reporters Roundtable. Bill, thanks once again for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
On this Reporters Roundtable Thursday, we take a look at the stories around Northwest Indiana covered by the reporters, and in this case, an investigative editor dealing with a matter that is of interest in Northwest Indiana and in Lake County in particular. Mark Chase with us from the Times office. Thanks for being with us, Mark.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. One of the things that a particular note we want to talk about, and I'd like to get a little background as well, too, on how you worked on this, and is the story that came out about Lake County Jail about those people who work as correctional officers and what was termed in the headline as runaway overtime. Set the stage for us very briefly on that.
Sure. Well, you know, I've spent a number of years going through county payroll data and other types of county expense data as well from department to department. We heard recently and over the years about the just massive amounts of overtime that are involved with some of the corrections officers at the Lake County Jail. So we kind of finally got around to requesting the payroll data for that particular department. I started going through it and sort of cleaning it up so that it was in a usable Excel format so that we could easily go through the data and sort of quantify what all that meant. And what we found was a situation where overtime in 2016 was at about $1.6 million or just under that for the collective 227 jail officers that were paid or compensated in 2016. A number of the jail officers, in fact, five of them made as much or more than the warden did on the strength of overtime. In fact, you had one jailer that made almost $92,000, or a little over $92,000 last year on the strength of almost $56,000 in overtime. So, we started talking to county finance folks. They talked about the sort of wily and out-of-control nature of overtime. It's a problem that's grown 168%. Under the tenure of the current two-term tenure of the sheriff that we have in the office now. And it seems to be both a budgetary issue and one of safety. People are wondering if jailers are putting in, you know, the top paid one, for instance, averaged 69 overtime hours a week. If you're putting in that kind of time, how effective are you and how sharp are you at your job?
Well, I wonder, you had one of the subheads in your article talks about, it's just a very simple question, when do they sleep? And that does raise a good question, you know, how much of your time do you spend at work and what's your personal time or family time, if you have any of that, it looks like.
Right, absolutely. It becomes a real concern. You know, you're working in one of the deadliest, well, not the deadliest places, you're working in one of the most dangerous potential places in Lake County, with some of the potentially worst, at least alleged worst, bad actors in our region where they're housed. I think you wouldn't want to be pretty sharp on your toes when you're doing that kind of work.
We had a chance to talk with, in particular, with Dante Rendelli, who is the chief bookkeeper for the Lake County Council. What is he telling you about all these issues? I'm sure he probably is just as perplexed about the overtime as anybody else.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's been pretty frustrating to him, to some members of the county council as well over the years who have to manage the county finances and approve the county spending when you have a certain amount budgeted and then the sheriff comes back several times throughout the year, in some cases requesting hundreds of thousands of dollars extra because of overtime that's already been worked that we now need to pay these folks, you know, and obviously under labor law. It can become quite a nightmare for budgeting. You know, I think they have control over it now, but you know, who knows how long that will last. We know that things kind of level out for a while, and then they tend to go up again. That comes in spite of the county council approving 42 new jailers within the last few years to help, you know, out of what they hoped would lessen this this load of overtime. In fact, it's just gone up under that time.
Mark, we only have maybe a couple minutes or so left, and I wanted to take this opportunity to give us a little insight. When you work on a story, and an investigative report like this, or a story that turns into one like this, apparently, you mentioned at the outset of our conversation here about having to work through all the data, come up with an Excel spreadsheet to be able to sort it all out then best. When you have to put something together that is so extensive as this nature, how long does it usually take to do things like this, and how much extra help or time that you have to spend on getting this together before it finally shows up, not only in print, but online?
Some of it depends. It depends on how willing the layer of government that you're working with is to providing electronic data. In this case, while Lake County has taken some lumps over the years for its open records and open meetings practices, They also do some good things, and one of those good things over the years has been their ability to provide us data electronically. It makes it a lot easier to ferret through. I mean, there's still some cleanup between their system and what is actually usable and readable for our readers that has to occur. In this case, you know, I spent a few weeks working on this project. There are other projects we've done that take considerably more time. Bill Dolan and I did a 10-year county spending analysis a number of years ago, where we had to clean up quite a bit of data, 10 years of overall Lake County government spending. And that took several months to sort of ferret through it and then figure out what the data meant.
And that's it's important to know, too, that you still have other things, like you have editorials to write or to put together for your colleagues on the editorial board to review and endorse. And you've got other stories, like in Bill's case, he's going to meetings all the time at the county government center, and he has stories he has to file online and in the newspaper. So you've got to fit all these things in around everything else, don't you?
Oh, absolutely. But, you know, these bigger picture things are why we got into the business, and I think it's why the readers keep coming back to the paper. They want to see the bigger picture and not just the short hits that we do in between.
Mark Chase is, among other things, he's the editorial page editor. He's also the investigative editor for the Times of Northwest Indiana. Mark, thanks for spending a little time with us to talk about this particular piece. We'll look forward to more in the future.
Thanks, Chris.
And we want to thank you for joining us here on this Reporters Roundtable Thursday on Regionally Speaking, and our many thanks not only to people like Mark Chase and Bill Dolan, but Ed Bierschenk from the Times of Northwest Indiana, and Michael Hawthorne in particular from the Chicago Tribune for a great piece that he has that you can see on the Chicago Tribune website and the Post Tribune website as well, too. And we hope you'll join us next week. This coming Monday, we're going to bring you a rebroadcast of the IPBS News special dealing with East Chicago's lead pollution and contamination. That's coming up on Monday's Regionally Speaking.